Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Tuesday, July 19th. I'm your host, Magnus Tiewald. I'm happy to be here and I'm happy you're out there listening to me today. We have a nice show lined up for you. We're going to start off with an interview with Vancouver High School student Elizabeth Zhao, who finished at the top of a national contest, and I'll explain a bit more about that in a minute. We're going to have some good music coming up. And we also have a feature from Talking Radical Radio about how climate disaster stories can serve as a catalyst for change. Plus Bird Note and, as I say, some great music and lots more. All right. Vancouver High School student Elizabeth Zhao entered a contest called My Future, My Challenge. My Money, My Future, a national challenge around fostering education on financial literacy. You know, the world is a difficult place to grow up in, and the more you understand how to work with and manage your money so that it works for you and that you can keep your finances, keep everything straight is super, super important. So she entered this contest and created a game called Lemon Co., which she explains a bit more about it in the interview. But the long and the short of it is it's a game in which you run a lemon stand and you have to make some choices about your running your stand, and also there's sort of a trivia or financial knowledge aspect to it too, where you have to answer some questions, correctly answer some questions about financial knowledge, financial literacy, managing your money. Elizabeth made it into the top 10 nationally, and that's why I was talking to her just a little while ago, as they were coming up to the final gala presentation of the winners. She made it into the top 10. Here's my interview with Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Lau is a Vancouver High School student who's been selected as a top 10 finalist from across Canada in the My Money, My Future Canadian Financial Education Challenge. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, and congratulations on this achievement. Maybe we can start out by you could tell me, what is the My Money, My Future Canadian Financial Education Challenge?
The My Money, My Future is an opportunity for you to create some sort of project that could be a song, a board game, a website, or anything you find that that helps you or helps other youth with learning about financial literacy. And for this, I chose to go ahead with a board game, and I actually created a website which makes it accessible for both on website and also in person.
That's great. How did you find out about the challenge and end up entering?
I actually found the competition through my teacher. I'm taking a marketing class in school right now, and I thought it would be a great opportunity for me to explore what I can do and also help other youth.
Great. And what grade are you in now? What school are you at?
I'm in grade 10 and I go to Sir Winston Churchill Secondary School.
Great. So for your entry, you created a game that teaches players about finances as they play. Can you tell me about it?
Yes. It is a board game, and basically there's a map and players, up to four players. You can play with your friends, your family members, and do each rounds. There's a lot of fun components, and basically you get
what's the game called?
Lemon Co.
Okay. And what's the sort of high level concept of the game?
You open Lemon Stand and you each round you earn or lose money. Mm-hmm. And through each round you select cards from certain deck, for example, a wild card, which might make you earn or lose money. And mm-hmm. there's also the customer card, which you draw out from a deck. And on each customer card, there's a story related to the customer and mm-hmm. a certain amount of tip that they might give you. And there's also a financial related question. And if you do answer the question correctly, the tip that the customer gives you doubles. The other card component is the Lemon Seed card. Mm-hmm. Basically, it is in the beginning of each round, you get to select a card, and that determines how sweet or how sour your lemon seed will be.
Right. So how does that influence your success in the game? The sweetness or sourness?
So the sweetness and sourness, there's an equation which calculate how many customer cards you get to pick out. Mm-hmm. And I believe the more sweet your lemon is, which is a number 3 on the card, and the most sour is a number 1 and neutral is number 2, you get to multiply how many lemon stands you have multiplied by how sweet or how sour your lemon C card, and mm-hmm. that equals how many customer you get to select out. Of course, the more customer cards you pick out, the more tip and the more earning you have. Right. And yeah, the same goes with how sour your lemon seed is.
So players have to manage their stand and hopefully they will be making money and be successful. Is that sort of the sort of aim of the game?
Yep, that's the aim.
So how is the winner determined?
The winner is determined when everyone else basically doesn't have money.
And, bit like Monopoly?
Yeah, a bit like Monopoly.
Great. So where did you get the idea for this game?
So when I first started out this project, I wanted to ask myself, what did I find joy in learning? And mm-hmm. when I thought about my childhood, when I was a child, I got a lemon plant. And it was a very confusing process because I thought a lemon plant, through 1 year, it would grow out lemons. But it actually took 3 years for me to grow an actual lemon. So I found that parallel to how my journey was for learning financial literacy. It was also a very long and confusing process. And I read somewhere research that the joy that children seem to have is something that adults, teenagers, and many youth spend many time trying to rediscover. And I want to implement that the same joy that I had growing a lemon tree with a board game that taught other youth on financial literacy. And I thought if I am able to do that, it could build and cultivate a positive relationship for students and other youth with money.
That's great. Did you have an interest in board games before you started this project?
Yeah, I grew up playing a lot of board games and, of course, Monopoly. So mm-hmm. I did have an idea in mind.
Right. Okay. So how did it feel to learn you'd made the final top 10 from students and young people entering from across the country?
I was overjoyed, of course. I still remember the day when I happened to check my phone, and I wasn't mm-hmm. supposed to look at my phone, but I just saw an email pop up, and I immediately sent it to my family group chat.
And what did your parents have to say?
They send a lot of emojis, all types of emojis.
So why do you think it's important for young people to learn about and gain financial literacy?
I think it's important because youth are the leaders of tomorrow. They will be the consumer customers, and they will ultimately be making the financial decisions that will be very crucial and directly impact what the world will look around us and Canada's economy. So I think it's very important to lay a solid foundation for them to understand the very important concepts that are often underestimated and overlooked.
So the final winner will be announced in just a few days. Are you excited or nervous?
I'm more I'm nervous.
It's a big it's a big deal. Have you thought about what you'll do with the money if you win?
I thought about treating myself and also my family to a dinner, but my mom suggested that I just save it.
Right. I guess that would be the financially responsible thing to do with the money, hey? What do you hope to do when you grow up, and do you have an idea of what your future plans are?
I'm sort of still exploring, but I'm interested towards business and also science.
That's great. Well, I mean, you are in grade 10. I think you got a little bit of time before you need to figure out your whole life. So, well, this is quite an achievement to make it to this point at the top 10 in a cross Canada competition. I did have a look at your website, which looks beautiful, by the way, for your game.
Thank you.
Can you tell people if they're interested and they want to check out your game, how do they find your website and have a look at your game?
You can go over to the My Money, My Future website, and I believe on the page that you land on, there will be other finalists also, their project that you can view. And beside British Columbia and also my name, you can go ahead and click it, and it will lead you to the website.
Great. Is there a simple URL for your website, though?
Pardon?
Is there a simple URL, or do they need to go via the My Money?
There's a URL. Should I read it out?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Is it simple or is it long and complicated?
It's kind of long and complicated.
Okay. Well, we'll put a when we post this up on our website, we'll put a link to it there. But we will tell people to go to the My Money, My Future website, which you can just Google that. My Money, My Future, the Canadian Financial Education Challenge, and that'll take you to the page with all the other finalists that Elizabeth mentioned. Congratulations on this, and good luck in the final competition.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining me today. Any last words you want to say before we head out?
Good luck to all the other finalists.
Great. Well, thank you, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Zhao, she's a grade 10 student at, what's your school again?
Sir Winston Churchill.
Sir Winston Churchill School here in Vancouver. Thank you for joining me today, and congratulations both on making it to the final 10, but also on creating a really interesting and fun game. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much.
That was Elizabeth Zhao, Vancouver student, high school student, and a finalist in the National My Money, My Future Challenge to create a financial literacy and financial education tool. In her case, she created a game called Lemon Co., and you can find a link to it from the My Money, My Future website, which is mymoneymyfuturechallenge.ca, or just Google My Money, My Future, comes right up. In late June, the national winners were chosen, and the grand prize winner, winning $10,000, was a team of Layla, Sarah, and Elena from Quebec, who created a financial literacy magazine. Second place went to Dana Zhao of Ontario, who created a four-week finance game plan called Making Finance Fun in Five Different Languages. And Danica Nell was the third place winner winning $2,500 for a book called Finances for Fun to help youth learn about about a variety of financial topics. And congratulations to Elizabeth Zhao for making it into the national top 10. Quite an achievement for her. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Speak Up. I'm your host, Magnus Thiebald. Let's have a quick look at Vancouver weather. It's a pretty nice day out there today, and it is expected to stay pretty nice for much of the week. Sorry, I'm just, this has been a pretty weird spring and summer so far, with not a lot of great sunny weather. I don't know about you, but I've been to the beach just once so far. I know there'll be more days that you could have gone than that, but this is the only time, only once has it sort of, has the nice day coordinated with my time off on the weekend. And so that's been kind of a drag, but it is, the forecast for this week is for sun and nice, comfortable weather for now through to the end of the week. Forecast for today is highs up to 22 degrees, mainly sunny with just a bit of cloud. Tomorrow we get a little cloud as well, but clearing through the day, highs up to 24. And then the rest of the week is sunny, sunny, sunny with temperatures in the range of 23 to 25 degrees, which is really nice because that's comfortable to be out in. And it cools down just enough at night down to, well, what it calls for 15, 16 degrees through the rest of the week, which is also pretty comfortable and manageable. Much better than they're doing in Europe, where in Britain and France and much of the rest of Europe, they're getting temperatures of up to 40 degrees or more, which is just crazy. I think we all remember the heat dome from last year and just how awful that was. Well, that's what Europe is experiencing right now, so we can feel for them. I think probably I would take a bit of the cool weather over the heat dome and out of control wildfires any day of the week. I had the pleasure of going to the Vancouver Folk Festival on the weekend. I wasn't there for the whole festival. I was just there on Saturday, but it was a fabulous day of great performances. The seasonal weather of so-so weather was definitely present through the weekend. On Saturday, the whole day, there were dark clouds in the sky, and they seemed to swirl and pass around our sight there at Jericho Beach. We only got a little misting in the early afternoon, and the rest of the day was fine. Again, you know, these dark clouds, it looked like they might roll over us at any time, and at one point they're what looked like pretty heavy rainfall on the North Shore that started moving across English Bay towards us, and you know, making the freighters in the bay there start to disappear behind the sheets of rain. But it never quite got to us, and that was nice. There were some great performances on the main stage in the evening, starting with Molly Tuttle and Golden Highway, who put on an awesome set of bluegrass and bluegrass-inspired music, a great foursome there. Then we saw Asleep at the Wheel, a legendary band that was responsible for a kind of mainstream rediscovery of bluegrass. Bluegrass never went away. Of course, it always had its audience within the country scene at the time. But Asleep at the Wheel came on the scene in the early 70s and brought that bluegrass to a wider national audience, including the sort of rock audience that had come through the 60s. And they've been amazing players, and they put on a terrific primer on bluegrass music and the music of Bob Wills. And then for me, the highlight was Alison Russell. She was the third on the main stage. And she put on a terrific, terrific performance and was clearly very thrilled to be there on Saturday night. And she told a really moving story about how she came to Vancouver. She's a former Vancouver resident. She's basing her career down out of the States right now. But she told a story about how she was living on the streets in Montreal, having run away from home. And her aunt and uncle drove all the way from Vancouver to Montreal to pick her up and take her back to Vancouver to live with them there. They're a bit of a musical family, and that was her introduction to music. And then she spent a number of years in Vancouver playing in bands and also working in addiction recovery on the front lines of what was then the emerging crisis with opiate addiction. And a lot of times, many times from the stage, she talked about just how happy she was to be back in Vancouver. It's her first time back playing at the Folk Festival since her time many, many years earlier when she played with the Vancouver-based band Pogue Girl. And it was a fabulous performance. She was so passionate, so full of joy, really thrilling. I'm going to play a song from you. This isn't from... obviously from Saturday night, but this is from her last album. This is called Night Flyer. Alison Russell here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
You I'm the one who can't be counted out. I'm the dove thrown into bed. I can roll and shake it.
Alison Russell from her debut solo project Outside Child. She was at the Vancouver Folk Festival on Saturday night, put on a stellar performance, kind of a homecoming for her after many years in Vancouver. And now she bases her career out of, I think it's Chicago, where she's living now and working from. I could be wrong on that, though. Let's move on to the next part of our show. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM, and we have a feature from Talking Radical Radio on how climate disaster stories can be a catalyst for change.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio.
What I certainly saw from 2017, I would say onwards, is really a failure on the part of the news media to accurately communicate the threat of climate change. And I certainly saw that most dramatically during wildfires in British Columbia. And here I was sitting in my apartment in Calgary expecting...
That's the voice of Sean Holman. He's today's guest on Talking Radical Radio. This show brings you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are involved in many different struggles, talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening can strengthen all of our efforts to change the world. Sean Holman is the Wayne Crooks Professor of Environmental and Climate Journalism at the University of Victoria in Lekwungen Territory on Vancouver Island, and he is a principal investigator for the Climate Disaster Project. Earlier in his career, for around a decade, Holman worked as an investigative journalist. Back in the years when such things were new, he ran an independent investigative site called Public Eye, a British Columbia-based project focused on journalistic staples like accountability and corruption, including with respect to issues like resource development, the environment, and child welfare. When he transitioned out of that work and into academia in the early 2010s, it was in part out of a desire to have the opportunity to reflect more deeply on why exactly journalism matters and on the importance in democracies of the public knowledge generated through journalism. He concluded that in the political environment of liberal democracies in the decades after the Second World War, information was crucial to publics making good decisions, exerting control over institutions, and experiencing a sense of certainty about the world. In more recent years, however, political life seems to be changing in some important respects. Holman said, quote, "Evidence-based politics is really on the decline, unfortunately, and maybe on its way out," end quote. Certainly there is room to debate the limits of such politics, even in their heyday. Power has always played a crucial role, after all. But there is no denying that these days, information and knowledge seem to have a reduced role in shaping the responses of both publics and institutions to the issues of the day. And things like right-wing authoritarianism and conspiracy theories are increasingly filling that space. There is no issue where the stakes of this shift are higher than the climate crisis. The evidence is clear and the potential consequences are existential, but institutions and governments deny it, either overtly in their statements or implicitly through their actions, and substantial publics do likewise. According to Holman, journalism has done, quote, very poorly in dealing with the climate crisis, though he sees some modest improvements in the last couple of years. However, because of the decline in what he describes as evidence-based politics, he argues that even if news media had done a better job, we might not be much better off. The central question in his most recent work is, given that, what could journalists be doing differently in how they engage with the climate crisis to better serve the public good? The Climate Disaster Project is a collaboration of journalism faculty working at over a dozen post-secondary institutions across Canada and around the world. The project has students work with survivors of the climate disasters that are hitting with increasing frequency, from hurricanes on the East Coast, to the intense derecho thunderstorm that hit Ontario earlier in the summer, to the fires that destroyed the town of Lytton, British Columbia last year, and many more. Rather than pursue conventional interviews with the survivors, students use an approach that is trauma-informed and collaborative to produce what are called as-told-to stories, first-person accounts in which people relate their experiences of whatever disaster they survived and its aftermath, and their thoughts about what they think needs to happen differently in the future. Along with providing a new and powerful sort of coverage for one of the defining issues of our era, another key goal of this work is to use the telling and sharing of stories to help build a broader sense of shared experience and community among survivors of disparate climate disasters, with the idea that this will not only be directly useful to survivors, but it might translate into more effective action to support survivors and to address the climate crisis. A central archive of the narratives produced through this project, called the Climate Disaster Survivor Memory Vault, will be launching in 2023. Another goal of the project is to launch solutions journalism and investigative journalism projects based on what survivors have said. Ultimately, the hope is that this project can offer a new model that journalists can add to their repertoire in the face of both the climate crisis and the challenges of the current political moment. I speak with Holman about the Climate Disaster Project.
My name is Sean Holman. I'm the Wayne Crooks Professor of Environmental and Climate Journalism at the University of Victoria, and I'm also principal investigator for the Climate Disaster Project, which works with climate disaster survivors to help them share their stories publicly and build community around that experience. I was an investigative journalist in British Columbia for 10 years. I was actually one of the early pioneers in the new media space. I launched a online investigative news service called Public Eye Online that also had a broadcast component as well, called Public Eye Radio, which was broadcast on CFAX 1070, which is a private radio station in Victoria and syndicated around the province. And what I was really focused on as an investigative journalist is accountability issues, corruption issues. And as part of that, I also provided significant coverage of resource development, environmental issues, and also child welfare issues as well. And I did that for 10 years. And as a result of that work, I got results. I think about 8 different public or party officials being, forced to resign or being fired as a result of investigations that I've undertaken, as well as major changes to law and policy. But I made a transition after 10 years into academia, where I became quite interested in why we value information in democracies. In other words, why exactly do we do this thing that we do as journalists? And why does a whole bunch of other sort of evidence-based professions do the work that they do? What is it about information that we value in democracies? The conclusion I came to after undertaking that work is we really value information for 2 reasons. One is control, and the other is certainty. So we value information because we can make better decisions about the world around us, thereby controlling public and private institutions, And we can also better understand the past and present and better predict the future, thereby feeling more certain about the world. And these two ideas, control and certainty, have really informed politics ever since the end of the Second World War, really. But what we're also seeing is a breakdown of evidence-based politics. Information is no longer providing the control and certainty that it used to. And that is opening the space for things like right-wing authoritarianism. That's opening the space for things like conspiracy theories. So this sort of era of evidence-based politics is really on the decline, unfortunately, and may indeed be on its way out. The environmental movement and the consumer protection movement, both in the 1960s and 70s, were really early adherents and early adopters of this, you know, evidence equals action formula. If only we can show people information, if only people know, then they will do something about these issues. And indeed, Rachel Carson, the author of Silent Spring, one of her favorite quotes from Jean Rostand, the French philosopher, was "the obligation to endure gives us the right to know." And that has been one of the founding sort of mobilizing principles of environmentalism. But again, this idea of evidence equals action is breaking down, and it's breaking down at the worst possible time when we are confronting what really is an existential threat to our way of life, to the environment in the form of climate change. That's to a certain extent how I arrived at doing the work that I'm doing. And what I'm really interested in right now is I'm interested in what does journalism need to do at this time of crisis? If evidence equals action is no longer really the world we're living in, what is the place of journalism and how can journalism help? How can journalism be of service against the backdrop of an ever-increasing disaster around the world?
What's your big picture sense of how journalism has dealt with the climate crisis?
It's dealt with it very poorly, I think. This was one of the motivating reasons for me to make a transition from studying the value of information to more directly studying and working in the climate space. What I certainly saw from 2017, I would say onwards, is really a failure on the part of the news media to accurately communicate the threat of climate change. And I certainly saw that most dramatically during wildfires in British Columbia that spilled smoke over the Rockies into Alberta. And here I was sitting in my apartment in Calgary, expecting that there would be significant linkage being made by journalists to climate change within the context of these wildfires. And I simply wasn't seeing that. I simply wasn't seeing that climate connection being made. So what was concerning for me was how can citizens possibly make good decisions about climate change? The news media wasn't providing that sort of vital information. But that said, I do think to an extent news media is doing somewhat better when it comes to climate coverage, certainly not where we would want it to be. But I think what my original approach did not take into account is the fact that maybe no matter how much evidence is out there, no matter how much information the news media accurately communicates about climate change, maybe we are in a situation where that evidence just doesn't matter and we need to find other ways of ensuring that we take action on climate change.
How did the Climate Disaster Project emerge?
I was interested in how could journalism be of service at this particular moment in time. And I don't just mean service. In other words, how could journalists help? What I mean is how could journalists be of service to populations that are being increasingly affected every single day by climate change? And that really came out actually of some work that I did around a CBC show from the 70s called The Ombudsman. What was interesting about the Ombudsman was people would write in to the show all across the country and talked to the ombudsman about the concerns that they were having with big government and the answers they weren't getting from big government. People would line up around the block when you went on these cross-country tours, just looking for someone to listen to them about the problems that they were having. It was an extraordinarily popular show. And that really got me thinking, like, how could we reverse the model of journalism? I think journalists often come into situations thinking that they are going to piece together what should be done about any given problem that they're reporting on. Instead, how can we really listen to people who are being affected by climate change and serve them as journalists? And I was also at the time really interested in things like the Innocence Projects down in the United States, which again is how can lawyers serve people who, you know, have been depowered, are powerless, and how can we work with those people to help increase their power? So that's really the etymological motivation behind the Climate Disaster Project. So what we do is we work with people who are climate disaster survivors through a trauma-informed process to help them share their stories, the stories of their experiences. And we don't just leave it at trauma that they've experienced. We also like to hear about not just the problems that they've experienced, but also the potential solutions to the problems that they've experienced. And then from those trauma-informed interviews that we do, we prepare what's called an as-told-to story, which is a story that is written only in the survivor's own words. So it provides a firsthand account of what these individuals went through and what they're hoping for in the future. And we're hoping for a couple things from those stories. We share those stories with the news media. We also are in the process of building a climate disaster survivor memory vault that will be an online repository for these stories. And what we're hoping to do is we're hoping to build community around the experience of climate disaster. Because if you think about it, the most powerful social movements of our time have really been about people sharing private stories publicly and forming community around those experiences. And that's not really happening when it comes to climate change right now. So can we change that dynamic and build strong community around this emerging identity of being a climate disaster survivor? We're also hoping to help empower those communities by, again, listening to what their solutions are, listening to what their common problems are, and then launching solutions journalism and investigative journalism projects around what our survivors have actually told us. The larger thing that we're trying to accomplish with the Climate Disaster Project is we also know in the absence of control and certainty, people look for pretty unhealthy forms of control and certainty, right-wing authoritarianism, conspiracy theories, etc. That's just going to become worse in the future. So what we're also hoping is that through this project, we can also help build more equitable, more resilient, more just evidence-based communities around the experience of climate change, because there's a real risk that as climate change becomes worse and worse, and as the crises that surround climate change become worse and worse, that you will see the development of the kind of communities none of us really want to see, communities with walls around them, exclusionary communities, racism and xenophobia like you wouldn't believe. That really is a potential future, and we really need to be thinking right now about how do we avoid that.
And how does the project work organizationally?
We're actually a network of a number of various different post-secondary institutions, not just around the country, but also around the world. We have 14 participating institutions next year, and that includes, you know, everyone from the University of Victoria, where I'm based, to the University of Queensland in Australia. And what we do is we actually run a class where students do this work. They work with climate disaster survivors, help them share their experiences, and then they launch solutions journalism and investigative journalism projects. And we find that this experience is really transformative for our students, because in a lot of ways, it also allows them to deal with the reality of climate change. It's not climate change in the future tense. It's climate change as it is happening right now. What can we do about it right now? And I think that's really valuable, because right now the climate movement is really a movement based on anxiety. It's based on future tense scenarios. And the gap that exists between the horribleness of what the future could look like versus the chances that we're going to take action to address that, to head those futures off. And that's not really a healthy space for many people to be in. So what can we do about climate change right now? What actions can we take when it comes to climate change right now that will be healthy, that we can build community around?
Walk listeners through the process in a little bit more detail.
I mentioned that we use sort of a trauma-informed process to do this work. What does that actually look like? Well, what we recognize is that people who have lived through disasters, which, by the way, is going to be all of us eventually, have experienced a profound lack of power and a profound lack of control. The news media really risks creating what's called a second wound when working with disaster populations, when working with any traumatized population for that matter. Because think about it, there's a lot about journalism that takes power away from the people that we work with. So what we do is we sit down with a climate disaster survivor for a pre-interview before we ever conduct the interview. And we do have a list of core questions that we'd like to ask as part of our work, but we don't just share those questions in advance, which is unusual, by the way, in journalism. Instead, what we do is we go through those questions. We ask our survivor what they think about those questions, whether or not they'd like to change them, whether or not they'd like to remove certain questions, whether or not they'd like to add certain questions. So what we're doing here is we're actually giving the survivor more control. And then we actually sit down for the interview. And from that interview, a transcript and an as-told-to profile are created. And then what we do is we provide the survivor with a copy of the transcript and also a copy of the as-told-to profile. This is the story that's written in their own words that's taught by a biography. And what we tell them is that they can remove any information that makes them uncomfortable. They can add information that they've forgotten about, or they can correct things that they got wrong. And within those boundaries, that then provides the survivor with, again, a lot of control. And it is only after we go through that process that we actually then share the story publicly. Now, this isn't a process that we would use for everyone. This certainly isn't a process for someone that we were attempting to hold to account. But it is a process that we use for people who are climate disaster survivors. And what that means is we are really, truly working with the populations. We're co-creating with the populations that we're working with these stories. And we think that's also important from a media trust building standpoint. A lot of these populations have a significant lack of trust in the media, in part because of the experiences that they've had with the news media covering their disasters. So it's a process that we have found to be extraordinarily rewarding, both for the students who end up administering these interviews and also for the survivors themselves.
What are some of the contexts where you've applied this approach?
We've actually done this work all across the country. We've talked to folks who were impacted by the intense storm that hit Ontario this summer. We've worked with folks up in Lytton in British Columbia, where the buildings there were destroyed by fire. We've worked with people who are survivors of hurricanes on the East Coast, and we've worked with people internationally as well. By the end of the summer, we expect to have 78 survivor interviews, and we expect to have another 100 in the fall.
I'm sure it varies a lot from person to person and from disaster to disaster, but what can you say in general terms about the kinds of things that you hear from survivors?
One of the things that we often hear from survivors is that the government isn't coming to help. And that's really troubling, but I think that's a reality that we're going to need to deal with. There's so many risks that we're not really thinking about right now when it comes to climate change. These disasters are really going to stretch the capacity of government to probably the breaking point. Government does not have the capacity right now to deal with the kind of disasters that we're seeing all around the world, and does not have the capacity to deal with the increasing frequency and severity of these disasters. And I worry about that, right? I worry about what that means. And I think it does point to the exact thing that our project is trying to do, which is build community around this experience. And can community fill the gaps the government really may be unable to fill over the next 30 years of unremitting and ever worsening climate change.
What kinds of responses to this approach have you had from your colleagues and from the broader media industry?
Obviously, this is a different approach than a lot of journalists use in their sort of day-to-day coverage. But it is at the same time not entirely abnormal within the trauma-informed space. So I think there's a lot of journalists out there who recognize the challenges that journalism currently has when it comes to working with vulnerable and marginalized populations in a really game for trying something new. There are, of course, also journalists who this process might be uncomfortable because it is different, right, than what we typically do as journalists. And I think that's okay. As someone who practiced very traditional investigative journalism for 10 years, I get it. This process doesn't mean I don't think that there's value in other journalistic processes. But I do think we need to try new things. And that's part of what the Climate Disaster Project is all about.
You mentioned that part of the goal of the project is to use this sharing of stories to build and empower community. In practical terms, how does that side of things work?
The three words that we use to summarize our work are story, community, hope. It starts off with the sharing of story, as I mentioned. And that's really important for community building because we can't possibly build community without knowing one another, to know and be known. And then it's not necessarily up to us to determine what that community is going to look like. It's up to us to try and help facilitate that. And we also will be doing that in the form of bringing climate disaster survivors together for forums, talk about, you know, climate disaster, talk about their experiences, share best practices, come up with solutions, et cetera, et cetera. And from that work, that's how we create hope. Because if we're able to start changing things, right, either through community action or through investigative journalism or solutions journalism, that really is what creates hope. The idea of we can actually have some control at this profound moment of profound instability and lack of control. And I think that's really the value of the Climate Disaster Project.
One of the key points of Rebecca Solnit's book about disasters was that when you look at them, you'll always see people who are already helping each other. What have you seen in that regard in terms of the climate disasters that you've covered?
We definitely have seen that. Lytton, which is the community that I just came from, 9 days of working up there, really embodies that. You know, communities helping one another, right? People helping one another. We visited with two folks who live just on Lytton First Nations land, and their farm was burned down. And as a result of the community coming together, they're now the first building to be rebuilt. And that was purely as a result of community action. It wasn't a result of government action at all. And I think that really points to the kind of strong communities that can be really built as a result of climate change.
What have you learned from your work on this project in terms of your original question about the roles that journalism can play in a context that's moving away from evidence-based action in the political sphere?
I suspect that journalism is going to become more about community building in the future than it is about providing control and certainty through information. And I can be sad about that, which I am. I can want to preserve evidence-based decision-making, which I hope I'm trying to do, as are all the other faculty who are leading this project. But I think we have to recognize the reality of where we're at, right, when it comes to evidence-based decision-making and the current state of evidence-based decision-making. It is a much different universe than the one that, for example, investigative journalism was born into. We're at a very different space and time. And I do think that in the future, control and certainty, we will look to community to provide that. And the question is, what kind of communities will we look to? Journalism has a real opportunity to help create more equitable, more just, more resilient, evidence-based communities as a result of climate change. if we don't do that, if we don't undertake this work, and if others don't undertake this work, the results could be pretty devastating for everything that we claim to cherish.
You have been listening to my interview with Sean Holman about the Climate Disaster Project. To learn more about it, go to climatedisasterproject.com. To find out more about Talking Radical Radio, the guests, the theme music, and the ways that you can listen, go to talkingradical.ca and click on the link for the radio show. On the site, you can sign up for email updates or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, SoundCloud, and other platforms. I'm Scott Nye, a writer and media producer based in Hamilton, Ontario, and the author of two books of Canadian history told through the stories of activists published by Fernwood Publishing. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in again next week.
This is Bird Note. We're walking in the Mexican countryside when we hear a chorus of raucous calls. A flock of brown jays has gathered nearby. Now, at the bend in the trail, we see them. A dozen chocolate-colored birds, nearly the size of crows, but slimmer. Brown jays are distinctive in appearance, but there's something else that sets them apart from most other birds. They are cooperative breeders. The entire flock takes care of a single nest, which holds four eggs laid by one female in the flock. Each bird in the flock will bring food to the young in the nest. When the young first leave the nest, they're vulnerable and naive. Nest helpers then teach the young to find food and recognize danger, complex skills necessary for survival into adulthood. In turn, the helpers may inherit the nesting territory when they come of age. Worldwide, about 3% of bird species, ranging from swifts to woodpeckers, are cooperative breeders. For some birds, a few extra beaks around the nest are the key to survival. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at BirdNote Radio.
And thanks for listening to Speak Up Today. We're just about out of time. Thank you for tuning in today. Coming up in about 2.5 minutes is Democracy Now, as it is every day at 11 o'clock. We're going to end the show with some music from Susie Ungerleider. She was performing at Saturday's Vancouver Folk Music Festival and put on a great set on one of the side stages. You may know her better by her the stage name she performed under for many years, Oh Susanna. Now she's performing under her own name, Susie Ungerleider. This is a song from her most recent album, Baby Blues. We won't have time to hear the entire thing before time runs out. I hope you enjoy this. It was a really nice performance on Saturday, both on her main performance and during one of the workshops. And I think you should check her out. This is Susie Ungerleider here on CJSF. Thanks for listening to Speak Up Today. Intravenous will be back tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Tune in for that and stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up in just a few moments.
You were driving the back roads last night, under the light of the stars, past fallow fields and broken down barns. When you reached the house with no light, you switched off the hum of the car and sat alone in the dark.